Welcome to the Nurture Hub Pregnancy and Birth Podcast with your hosts, Shari Lyon and Nicola Lay.
Together, we bring over 30 years of experience in working with women and partners through education, breathing, mindfulness, and evidence-based information, and nurturing you through this transformation into motherhood.
Join us on this journey as we connect with women and partners, mentoring, supporting, and navigating the ups and downs of becoming parents.
Hello, hello, beautiful mamas. Welcome back to this next episode of the Nurture Hub Pregnancy and Birth Podcast. My name is Shari Lyon and Nicola and I are so excited to share this journey with you. Now, on today's episode, we are delighted to welcome one of my beautiful clients. Her name is Celine. So Celine is actually a women's health and hormone nutritionist. And when I heard that this was her profession, I said to her, I've got to get you on the podcast. Celine runs an online women's health clinic in which she consults with women on a range of different reproductive conditions, including PCOS, endometriosis, thyroid conditions, and more. But recently, through her own journey to becoming a mother, she's now starting to work with women right from preconception through to postpartum. And I wanted to invite her to come on as a professional nutritionist to talk to us about common, challenges that we face during pregnancy with nutrition, with, our hormones and gestational diabetes and iron levels and all of that. So I'm really excited to have her on. But once again, we just need to reiterate any information that we share in any of our episodes should never be seen as medical advice. This information is to be only seen for informational purposes, and I really encourage you to get out a pen and paper so you can write down some good quality questions to take to your caregivers if you are low in iron or if you have gestational diabetes. So sit back, enjoy this beautiful episode. Well, welcome, Celine, to the Nurture Hub Pregnancy and Birth Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on this cold and chilly morning on the Gold Coast.
No, thanks so much for having me, both of you. This is actually my first interview with two interviewers, I guess. So I'm very excited.
Oh, welcome. It's so good to have you in here. And what an amazing subject today, all about nutrition and pregnancy and fertility as well.
And we're going to ask some questions that a lot of our clients ask us just in regards to gestational diabetes, iron levels and things like that during pregnancy. So we can't wait to delve into these topics with you because it is becoming so paramount, like with the testing and everything that's being done. Gestational diabetes in pregnancy seems to be rising. And we'd love to just understand a little bit more, why. But first of all, we'd love to just hear your story because you're so pregnant yourself. That's how we met. You came to one of my classes. It was, I think, last month, wasn't it? And that's where we connected. And I was like, I've got to get you on. tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a nutritionist.
So like I think many health practitioners, my journey started through my own personal experience. Such a classic cliche story, I think, for women in general. I went on birth control very young, so 15, 16, came off it and had no menstrual cycle whatsoever, about 19, something like that. Went to a, and I'm skipping lots of details here for time's sake, but, went to a women's health doctor or GP and was sent away for further testing, an ultrasound and blood testing, and was essentially told, just go back on the pill until you're ready to have a baby. That's the best option. And I'd love to say that, working now in clinic, that advice has changed, but I quite frankly can say that it hasn't. And so that whole experience really sent me down a journey of kind of looking for alternate options, really, and alternate health advice, if you want to call it that. So I met a naturopath and she went through my test results with me and were like, oh, no, these results are not fine at all. Basically, it looks like you've gone through menopause at 19 because I had no hormonal activity at all. And so we did a whole range of different things, mainly dietary changes, herbs, acupuncture, a whole list of different things, really. And then within, it was about 3 months, 3-4 months, I did have a cycle back and have had one ever since. But really that process kind of opened my eyes to issues with women's health in general, and just also how life-changing it can be when you find that health practitioner or that person that listens to you properly and also can provide advice, I guess, that makes a difference for you. So as cliche as it is, that was sort of my like catalyst event, if you will. And I was doing something completely different at the time, had not really much prior interest in sort of, you know, nutrition or studying a health degree or anything like that. But I, after that experience, went off and did I actually did a nutrition and dietetics degree at Griffith Uni. So quite a conventional degree, but, knew that I didn't want to be a dietitian at the end of it. I was more aligned with, the air quotes sort of natural or complementary medicine side of things. So I did that, and now I'm actually doing a master's in reproductive medicine as well. And I have my own online clinic, where I work with women all across Australia and sort of all sorts of hormonal issues. And now also, you know, through my own experience of being pregnant at the moment, have been doing a lot more sort of preconception care work and, pregnancy, postpartum, that kind of thing as well.
Wow, what a journey. I can see that naturally would have gone that way, hey. A question that I know for sure, and it's something that having worked with pregnancy now for such a long time myself, is the concerns that women have about their own nutrition in pregnancy and to be able to understand what that looks like. Open that up for us.
Yeah, I think I see that a lot in clinic, where women might feel more anxious or more pressure around being as healthy as they can be and eating the all the air quotes like correct and right foods. If you want to keep it super simple, like real food, so food from the ground, from a tree or from an animal, you really can't go too wrong if you're sticking mostly with those foods. Obviously, you don't have to be an angel, but as much as possible, like 80-90% there. However, what I recommend to especially all my preconception clients, ideally like 3 to 6 months before you're falling pregnant is amazing. But if you haven't allowed for that time, that's also totally okay. Don't freak out. Is getting a full spectrum of different blood tests done so that we can actually see what nutrients you might be deficient in, leading into what we're going to talk about, obviously, in this interview, looking at your blood sugar control as well and where that's sitting at. But we want to look at things like iron. We want to look at things like zinc, because I know a lot of women just kind of take a prenatal and think that that's maybe the end of it. And, you know, I'm sure maybe this has been touched on, but like, please no one ever take Elevit. I hope I'm allowed to say that, but please don't ever do that. So you want to take a good quality prenatal with natural forms of folate, ideally around 3 months before, but also understanding that a prenatal is like a very small insurance policy. If you have quite significant nutrient deficiencies, it's just not going to touch the sides for a lot of things. Say for example, if there's a, you know, an iron deficiency present, and you've not identified that, you're obviously going to be at risk of, you know, iron infusions later in pregnancy, because quite frankly, the, reference ranges, I suppose, that, are used across Australia are just far too loosey goosey. So we're just not picking up, I guess, like early issues with those sorts of nutrients. So I think, you can get really, really personalized with your nutrition and supplements, if you're doing that blood testing, because we're basically, it's like taking your car to the mechanic, really. You're able to get a look under the hood at sort of what's going on in your particular blood and your nutrient status, and make things a lot more personalized than just kind of like standard across the board pregnancy nutrition. But I think, you know, if that's not available to you, or you don't sort of have the capacity to work with a practitioner, that's also fine. But just real foods, proteins, fats, carbohydrates, food from the ground, from a tree, from an animal, you really can't go too wrong if you're mostly aiming for that.
So what are the signs of an iron deficiency for women in pregnancy? Because, I mean, like early pregnancy, like you're tired anyway, like
I mean, I think it was only really a few weeks for me that I felt like really good. I felt tired, but I didn't believe, I never was tested for iron, but could you give us a little, just for our listeners to understand, like, what are the signs or symptoms of an iron deficiency?
So signs and symptoms will be shortness of breath, which again, kind of frustrating in pregnancy because you kind of feel short of breath anyway, but shortness of breath, often dark circles under the eyes, easy bruising, fatigue. It can be anxiety as well. A lot of people don't realize that anxiety is often a symptom of low iron, as is insomnia and sleeplessness. So there's a lot of crossover in general, just from the pregnancy hormones and all the changes that your body's going through. It's very easy to sort of miss that or blame the fatigue, because fatigue is that you sort of the your key symptom of iron deficiency just on being pregnant, right, and growing a human. But with iron, I recommend, you know, trimester one, you really want to be getting that done. So full iron studies, you also want to be getting your full blood count as well. So not just ferritin. Ferritin is like the marker that most GPs or doctors will look at alone. You don't want to just get that test done, because it's it's only basically part of the information that we need. And you also want to get something done called high sensitivity CRP, which stands for C-reactive protein. So this is a marker of non-specific inflammation. So if you have inflammation present in the body, that's actually going to change the accuracy of your iron results as well. And then on that, you know, making sure that the testing is done accurately is really important. So first thing in the morning, get it done fasted, no exercise beforehand, all that sort of thing. And then ideally you want to have that done trimester one. If you haven't had it done then, that's okay, but trimester two. And then you can make really informed decision based on, I guess, where those markers are at, about how you're going to move forward and be preventative about not needing an iron infusion.
I think what I noticed for myself, because I was iron deficient, I'm naturally that anyway, the GP just, they didn't really sort of give me a good idea of how, like, how bad it was, or they just kept having, I kept having iron infusions, but never actually felt much better, to be fair, through both my pregnancies. Would you suggest then that perhaps a GP can look at it, but they might need to take a second opinion if they don't feel better? Because often a woman will go and present themselves at a GP and they think they're okay, when actually they're still not feeling better.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can give specific markers. I know I said before, it's not just about ferritin, but, you know, for simplification, trimester one, you really want a ferritin of a minimum 50, which the standard reference range cutoff is 30. So if you're starting off pregnancy with a ferritin of 30, you're going to find it very difficult to actually not end up in a position where you're needing an infusion. Because what happens in pregnancy is trimester one, there's not much change in terms of your iron requirements. Trimester two, baby's needs really start to increase. And then by the end of trimester two, around about 26 weeks, you've got hemodilution starting to occur. Baby's needs significantly increasing in trimester two. And so your iron requirements are going up, but also the blood volume that you're having is becoming greater. So that marker is also becoming more dilute in solution. So that's important to understand, is that your iron is going to go down in pregnancy regardless of what you do. And that's a natural, normal, physiological adaptation of pregnancy. It is supposed to happen. Speaking, I guess, from my own experience, I had a ferritin of just over 100 when I started pregnancy, which was the highest mine's ever been. So I really worked on that, getting that nice and high. I'm now trimester three and it's 35. It's still normal and it's still fine and healthy for trimester three, but you know, a GP could potentially look at that and say, oh, that's a huge drop. You know, maybe you should get an infusion. So I guess just to go through that, trimester one, you really want to be looking for around a minimum of 50, because that's going to basically mean that you've got enough iron to kind of keep you going ideally throughout the trimesters. And if you don't have a ferritin of 50, that's where we'd be looking at, if you eat red meat, we'd really be wanting to be look at increasing, if we can, depending on what food aversions you might have, beef and lamb in those, in that early trimester. and maybe even prophylactically using like a low dose iron supplement. So we don't have to go too much into that, but like, please no one take Multifor or Ferrograd C because they'll make you feel constipated and sick most of the time. And they're too high dose. They're actually, they're not very effective at increasing your iron levels. You want something that's low, so no more than 50 milligrams, and taking that every second day. And then trimester 2 and 3, we really need to just understand that your iron is going to go down, and we're not supposed to be basically applying standard reference ranges for women in trimester 2 and 3. And that is what's commonly done. So the standard reference range for iron, if you're not pregnant, would be bottom of the rung 30, which might go up to, depending on the lab and where you are in Australia, 150 to 200, let's say, being the top. But what we know from how your iron status is supposed to naturally change during pregnancy, what we should be looking for in those later trimesters is basically a ferritin of say 15 to 40 being acceptable. And then making sure as well that we're looking at your hemoglobin and maintaining that over 105. So it's quite different to sort of what you would be looking for if you weren't pregnant. But we just really need to understand that it's not suitable to apply those standard reference ranges to pregnant women in those later stages of pregnancy, because your requirement for iron is just so much higher than it was previously, and the baby's needs are increasing so much.
Wow. That's so useful.
How effective are the iron infusions?
Well, basically, again, this is kind of another issue. If your ferritin's not below 15, and your hemoglobin is not under 105, you're not considered anemic. So you have low iron, but you're not considered anemic. Now, from the research, it's basically, if you're not anemic, it's actually completely inappropriate to be prescribing an infusion. And very commonly, I see that being recommended where, you know, say in my situation, I had a really good ferritin. It's dropped to 35. If mine was say 20, I wouldn't be surprised if a GP recommended that I get an infusion, because it's like, wow, that's such a big drop, and kind of like panic mode is kind of ignited, I guess. And what we know is that basically if your ferritin is not under 15, you'll be provided that infusion, your ferritin will shoot up. So it might go up to say even into the 300 marks, because an infusion, for I guess context, is about the same amount of iron delivered in a matter of minutes that it would take you to eat in a year of consuming red meat. So it is a huge amount of iron. So it does increase your ferritin. Now, ferritin, for anyone that's not sure, is your storage form of iron, iron stored within the liver, but it's not a marker of iron delivery throughout the body. So it's kind of like what you have in the storage cupboard, but not representing what's being delivered to the tissues. And what we know from a few research papers is that if someone's not truly iron deficient and truly anemic, the transferrin, which is another marker in your iron status panel, starts to go down. Now, transferrin actually represents the delivery of iron across the placenta to the baby as well. And so that's really interesting, because if, say, an infusion is being incorrectly recommended, there is the potential that, you know, we get this big rise in ferritin, which is maybe going to appease the healthcare provider, but possibly not going to actually improve the baby's delivery of iron. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in general with iron, we just want to be on the front foot with it, because it's really, really easy to end up in a situation where you do have a ferritin under 15 if that iron hasn't been correctly managed. And if you were starting out pregnancy with low iron, and you were proactively looking at improving that, whether it's through diet and supplements, I would really be getting at least a hemoglobin and a ferritin test done maybe every like 10 to 12 weeks, just so that if there is any issues there, you're not waiting until you're in trimester 3 to pick that up, which is commonly what's happening. And then you're left in a situation where all of a sudden it's a surprise to you that you're finding out your ferritin's under 15 and an infusion's being recommended to you. if you really need an infusion and you are iron deficient anemic, then, you know, if that's recommended, I do think that's an appropriate suggestion. You should get one. I'm not saying that kind of, you know, across the board they're bad or no one should be getting them, but it's just understanding whether that is an appropriate suggestion or whether you just have low iron as a normal part of pregnancy. And then I think also making sure that hopefully we're managing that correctly. And I'd like to say that that your healthcare provider will sort of keep on top of that for you, but unfortunately I just don't really see that being the case. I think that we sadly need to be informed about these things ourselves and take it upon ourselves to be asking these questions and asking about getting testing done. Yeah.
That's amazing and sad at the same time.
Yeah.
So Shari and I often talk about this. It's like a real passion conversation for us and for you, I know. Talk to us about the procedure for testing for gestational diabetes.
Yes, I would love to. So GDM or gestational diabetes is commonly screened for around about 26 to 28 weeks. And the gold standard test for that is the oral glucose tolerance test, or the OGTT. So the test is basically to screen for how well your body clears glucose from your bloodstream. And it is to screen for gestational diabetes. That's what we're looking for with that test. The test itself involves going to the pathology lab and sitting down for 2 hours and drinking 75 grams of glucose. So for context, 75 grams of glucose is the equivalent of 2 cans of Coke or 18 teaspoons of sugar. And then you're meant to drink it within a 5-minute period. And then they basically measure your blood sugar response, or what's left in your blood, at 1 hour and 2 hours after drinking that solution. And the reason that it's done at that point in pregnancy is because naturally at that point in pregnancy, you do become slightly more insulin resistant. That's a natural, normal part of pregnancy. It's actually to allow your body to deliver more nutrients to the baby. So that is supposed to happen. And so that's why the recommendation is to screen women at that particular point. Now, I think a big misconception with GDM is that women just sort of spontaneously develop gestational diabetes in pregnancy and it kind of just comes out of nowhere. But it's just quite frankly not true. I think there's a lot of, I guess, stigma around getting a GDM diagnosis as well for women. So I just want to, I guess, highlight that and know that if you do get diagnosed with it, it's really not the end of the world. Like, you can manage your blood sugar really effectively in a matter of days. And the most effective way to do that is through diet. And we can go through some specific ways that you might do that. But I guess the issues I have with the test is that it's not really appropriate for everyone to be doing that test. So say, for example, and I know, Shari, you talked about this a lot in your course, is like, if you don't know that options A, B, and C exist, you'll probably only be offered option A. And I found this in my own personal experience and obviously working with clients. I'm always talking to my trimester one and preconception clients about, you know, alternate options and even later in pregnancy as well. But from my own experience, what I did in trimester one and what I recommend my clients do as well is go and get an insulin test or fasting insulin test, an HbA1c test, and a fasting blood glucose test. The reason is that this is the most effective way to really assess your risk. Now, I obviously already knew from how I eat that I was going to be very low risk anyway. But what that told me is that my fasting blood glucose was under 5, my HbA1c was under 5.3%, and my fasting insulin was between 3 and 5. So that's really what you're looking for to be like, okay, I am low risk for GDM. And so then when that conversation did come up with my doctor, it was interesting there. It wasn't, you know, we need to screen you for gestational diabetes. Here are some different options that, you know, you might be interested in. It was like, at your next appointment, I'm going to give you the referral to go and do your oral glucose tolerance test. End of discussion. Like, you just got option A. And I sort of said, well, you know, from my understanding, I'm very low risk. This is how I eat day to day anyway. And these were all my markers in pregnancy. So in trimester one, pardon me. So I'm actually not going to go and do the glucose tolerance test. I said, if you really want me to, I can do some at-home glucose monitoring once I hit 26 weeks, but I'm not going to go and sit there and drink the equivalent two cans of Coke when I would just never consume that on a day-to-day basis anyway. And from a logical perspective, as someone who doesn't eat like that, I wouldn't really want to be doing that to my body or my baby at that point in pregnancy anyway. For the test to be accurate, which is often not explained to people either, you need to be eating 150 grams of carbs a day leading up to the test. So that's the equivalent 10 slices of bread. Now, there's plenty of other ways to get carbohydrates in, obviously fruit, potato, rice, bread, and cereals and things. But just for context, like, you know, if someone's eating like a paleo sort of style diet or naturally eating slightly lower in carbohydrates, the test itself isn't going to actually be accurate for them. And now I fall into that camp of eating probably like quite standardly around 100, 120 grams a day. And the doctor would have never explained that to me, right? So had I not had that knowledge, I would have gone and done the test. And in doing that, would mean I have a very high chance of having what's called a false positive result from that test, whereby because I don't eat 75 grams of carbs, I nearly eat that in a day. I'm not going to have a very positive response to that test. My body's really going to struggle to actually clear that sugar from my bloodstream. And the reason that that happens is because your body sort of gets used to how much is generally coming on a day-to-day basis. So let's say my particular body might go, Celine normally eats, you know, 25 to 30 grams of carbs with each meal. So I know that when she's eating, I'm going to pump out X amount of insulin. So all of a sudden you've got 2-3 times that coming in one go. And I guess the other point to the test is that it would be very rare for someone to eat, well, I hope it would be, 75 grams of sugar with no proteins or fats. Like, that in itself is just ridiculous. Even if you were to go and eat a really, really high carb meal, like let's say you go out for pasta or something like that, I don't know, it's going to have most likely some form of proteins or fats in it, which is going to help stabilize your blood sugar response. Whereas with this test, you're literally just going and drinking 75 grams of sugar on its own.
So crazy. And I remember sitting in there, because I was an older 38 when I had my first pregnancy and 41 when I had my second. So they do like a secondary test when you're over a certain age. And I remember feeling like I was going to throw up because it was so big for me, because I had hyperemesis as well. But yeah, it's crazy that you put it into context of that much sugar. And no, you're right. No one tells you how to prepare for that test.
They don't ask these questions at all to individuals. What is your diet? What are you consuming before deciding the dosage of glucose? They give every single woman the exact same dose and test them all the same, not taking into account their daily, you know, diet, how they live their life, even, you know, I guess size, shape, all of that kind of stuff. Wow. That's,
it's just a one size fits all approach, I think. And I think that's the big issue, is like all pregnant women have a different health history. All pregnant women have, eat different amounts of carbohydrates, have a different, blood sugar control. And so it's just inappropriate really to be classing us all the same. And then arguably anyway, if someone was to have an issue with blood sugar, like, why are we waiting until 26 to 28 weeks to kind of pick that up? Why are we not actioning that really early in pregnancy and saying, look, there is this underlying predisposition to blood sugar issues, which means you are more at risk of gestational diabetes. Let's not wait till 26 weeks to actually work that out. And let's start making it those changes, those dietary changes, like now, rather than waiting till then. And you know, the argument there is that, well, at that 26 to 28 weeks is when women are becoming more insulin resistant. But, you know, I think I'll eat my words, but I would be hard pressed finding someone that had really good blood sugar control to start with that just spontaneously develops gestational diabetes at the end of pregnancy, right? Like it's, there is an underlying issue there. We're just not screening for it.
Right. And so in the UK, I've been told that where I'm from, they don't test in that same way. Mm. It's an option, but they don't test unless someone's presupposed to having diabetes. So
yeah. And the other, like the irony is that if you do get a positive diagnosis from the GTT test, the recommendation is then to go home and do at-home glucose monitoring anyway, where you're looking for a fasting blood glucose of no more than 5 and a 2-hour postprandial, which means 2 hours after eating, blood glucose of no more than 7. And I just, yeah, can't really understand why we're maybe not starting there. If that's then the recommendation anyway, like say for someone like me who was low risk, that was what I was recommended to do. But equally someone that gets diagnosed with GDM is also recommended to do that and then receives dietary advice, which is another issue in of itself as what they're recommended to do from a dietary perspective. But yeah, it's just like very strange.
So what are the parameters that they're looking at when they do the test? What are the parameters, and what if women are just outside of that? What could that mean? And then if they go and do the daily testing and it is within the normal range, what is that telling them?
Yeah, so the positive diagnosis as per like the Royal College of Royal Australian College of GPs is that you have 2-hour postprandial from the glucose tolerance test of fasting blood glucose of more than 8. and then, as I said, yeah, the recommendation is to go away and do that at-home glucose monitoring. Essentially, there are plenty of reasons why you could be just outside of that. It could be like A, that's just a huge amount of carbohydrates and your body's not cleared that quite efficiently. Obviously, when you're going home and doing that measurement at home, it's very unlikely you're sitting down to eat 75 grams of sugar. You're probably having maybe still some carbohydrates, but it's not just going to be, like I said, a glass of sugar on its own. So like I think the test in general is just very unrealistic of what women would actually be eating on a day-to-day basis anyway. If you are measuring slightly high at home, like the reality is that blood sugar control is very simple. Like if you've got high blood sugar, that's an indication that your body's intolerant to carbohydrates. At the end of the day, it's an intolerance to carbohydrates. And so the recommendation needs to be that there is a moderation in carbohydrate intake, and we're also looking at proteins and fats and really increasing those. So I think if you do have a GDM diagnosis, obviously, you know, you should get ideally one-on-one advice anyway, but like you want to move away from having carb-centric meals. So that's going to be things like your oatmeal, porridge, pastas, sandwiches, things like that still have carbohydrates, but you need to be thinking them as them more of a condiment on the plate than like the, I guess, hero of the dish, because having high blood sugar is an indication that your body cannot tolerate the amount of carbohydrate that you're eating. And it's really as simple as that, like increasing protein and moderating the amount of carbohydrate. But when you look at what's recommended from the Australian guidelines point of view, they recommend carbohydrates with every meal and every snack, and they recommend like protein of minimum 2 serves a day, which to me just like I was like sweating with anger when I was reading them because it just makes no sense, like with what we understand about physiology and what that high blood sugar is telling us. Your body's just intolerant to carbohydrates and not able to handle what's coming in. So why are we then getting you to eat them all the time?
Right.
Yes. So can you explain what the risks are to women whose levels are maybe higher, if they're not able to control through diet, what are the actual risks? Because this diagnosis of gestational diabetes is now leading to huge recommendations of induction at 39 weeks. And even for women who have normal sugar levels, or normal, you know, they're testing their daily levels and they're normal, they've now been kind of slapped with this label and put in this box. And even if they're able to control it, they are being recommended induction at 39 weeks and this whole big baby, you know, part is kind of coming up. So can you maybe just explain from your nutritional point of view and also from the baby's point of view, what are the actual risks? And yeah, what I want to really do in this interview with you is just help women create questions and go to their caregivers and go, do I actually need this test? You're telling me this, but it doesn't make sense. So yeah, would you mind explaining from like, what are the risks?
Yeah, I think, well, the big one that's always talked about is macrosomia with the larger baby. And I guess that's the reason that induction is recommended, but it's not like an A plus B equals C sort of example where all women that have gestational diabetes even end up with a larger baby. And you hear that all the time where women are told that their baby's measuring too big or what have you, and then the baby comes out at like 2.9 kilos, right? So yes, it is a risk factor, but it's not a definitive outcome. There is also, I guess, with unmanaged high blood sugar risk, if it continues to be high and you were to do nothing about it, you'll probably end up with a type 2 diabetes diagnosis outside of pregnancy. Like that is a risk for you. And then there is some research as well showing, I guess, that baby is at risk later in life of developing, you know, like metabolic health conditions and those sorts of things. But I think that more so comes from blood sugar issues are such an environmental issue. Like it's your diet, it's what you're eating day to day. So I don't know necessarily that we can make that association that it's actually what's happening when the baby's in gestation versus there being no environmental change later on in life, if that makes sense. But I think, I guess to answer your question, you can manage your blood sugar just like so easily. I think that just really needs to be acknowledged that it might not necessarily feel easy, but it's really simple to do. It's not hard. And at the end of the day, if you're able to present those readings to your healthcare provider and say, look, I am measuring my blood sugars. I think it's recommended about 4 times a day on fasting and they're under 5. I'm measuring them 2 hours after eating and they're under 7. Like you essentially don't have gestational diabetes, right? That's proof that your body is clearing that glucose really effectively, both fasting and after eating. And at the end of the day, like it's up to you what I guess advice you take and follow as a result of that. But regardless of whether you've gotten a positive reading to a glucose tolerance test, if you're able to provide that evidence that your blood sugars are actually well managed day to day, I think that's like proof enough that, you know, you're not at risk of those complications.
That's very interesting, isn't it? What if somebody, what does those day tests look like? What do they have to do? Do they have to do a pinprick or?
Yeah, pinprick. You can buy, they're really not too expensive. They're about $50 to $80. There's, I always forget the name. It's something, I think Freedom Libre or something like that. But if you just Google blood glucose monitor or finger prick, it's normally the first one that comes up. And they're around that $50 to $80 mark. So it's just a finger prick. And then you get little test strips as well. So it's super easy to do. You just prick your finger on waking. And that's where you're looking for that 5 or under measurement. And then you basically just put the strip up to your finger, a little bit of blood goes into that, and then you put that strip into the reader and it will tell you what your glucose is measuring at. And then you just want to do it 2 hours after eating as well, to understand. And really what that reading is telling you, I guess, is whether you're eating too many carbohydrates for your body, right? Like that essentially is what that 2 hours after eating is measuring. And so, for example, if your reading after breakfast is consistently high, but your readings after lunch and dinner are fine, well, that's an indication that whatever you're having at breakfast, you need to make some tweaks there, right? So let's just say it's, I don't know, a banana smoothie with minimal protein in it, and maybe you've got some fats in there. So how you would be adapting that is, let's not maybe take out the banana, but if you're having one, let's drop it back to half and maybe add some raspberries in there, or even some, I know this will sound weird, but like some frozen zucchini, and let's really increase that protein amount to make sure that you're having at least 25, 30 grams of protein in that smoothie. Then you're going to measure it the next day, and most likely it's going to be under 7 now, because you've adjusted the amount of carbohydrate and you've also increased the amount of protein. And that's really like your biggest bang for buck strategy when it comes to improving your blood sugar, is looking at making sure you are having a full serve of protein with every single meal. And if your blood sugars are measuring high after that meal, you do need to make some adjustments to the carbohydrate serving.
And you know what it's like when you're pregnant, as you know, you're craving carbohydrates as well. So it's hard for a pregnant woman to
have
that balance, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think it can be hard. I think ultimately, like, if you've been probably labeled with that GDM diagnosis, you're probably going to be highly motivated to see that change on the blood sugar strips, right? But I think in an ideal setting, we're kind of getting that information well before you're at trimester 3. So you can make really informed decisions about what kind of testing you want to do. And there's also another test that's not commonly talked about, which is fructosamine testing. You can normally request that from your midwife as well, but that's sort of another alternative to the GTT test. And that's just a blood test, and it does measure a 2 to 3 week trend in blood sugar control. So again, it's really non-invasive. Why we're not doing this test instead, I don't know. I can't answer that question for you. But yeah, that test you can request at around, say, 27, 28 weeks, because it is that 2 to 3 week trend, it's still going to be accurate for picking up that, adaptation of being more insulin resistant at that point in pregnancy. So that's also an alternate option. And normally if you have a midwife, you can have that sort of conversation with your midwife and maybe ask if you could opt for that test instead, or whether that would be a suitable option for you. So that's a really great question as well to take to your care provider.
I love that. I didn't even know that that was a thing.
No. Yes, like, again, if you don't know options A, B, and C exist, right, you'll probably only be offered option A.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just worrying, because you feel like you, as a new mom, like, you know, you want to trust the people who you have chosen to care for you, but when they're not giving you all the options and really explaining to you the reasons and why and the benefits or the risks or alternatives, then it could lead you down a whole different journey, which may not have been needed. And that's why we do what we do, is because it's about asking questions. And I've taken this from when we interviewed Binny Nicola, that, you know, the quality of the questions you ask determine the quality of the answers you get. So with any test or procedure or intervention or recommendation, you need to empower yourself in either finding out this information or asking the right questions to ensure you're getting all the information to make the decision as to whether you want to have the test, and to know that any intervention, any test is a recommendation. It's not the law. You don't have to do anything if you don't want to, scans or anything. And I'm not here saying Of course not. But it's important to understand. I think a lot of women don't understand because they're not given any of the options. It's just, okay, here's your referral, go and get the test. You know, they're not really explained what's involved with the test, that they have to fast before the test. Because that's the other thing as well. Mm. You've got to fast for a long period of time.
Yeah, overnight. You have to do it in the morning. So about 8 to 12 hours of overnight fasting, which again, yeah, no one really explains. I often find that with blood tests as well. No one really tells you that.
And so if they fast longer or less, could that have
change
in the results? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So if you fast for too long or too little, that will definitely affect the results.
Yeah. See, that was never explained to me. When I did my test 11 years ago, it wasn't the 2-hour testing and mm-hmm. I didn't have to fast. I did it in the afternoon and I went in and I think they took bloods and then I drank it and then I had to wait an hour and then they took bloods again and I was fine. And then that's why for my second pregnancy, I was like, I know I'm low risk and I'm personally making an informed decision. I'm not going to test for the second baby. And my gosh, the way I was looked at by these medical caregivers was like, how dare you make that decision for yourself? And I really had to stand into my power and advocate and go, I understand the risks. I'm taking responsibility for any risks. And that was the decision that was right for me. But wow, it's been such an eye-opening chat.
Yeah. I mean, I think if pregnancy doesn't teach you to advocate for yourself, like nothing will, right? But it is just interesting, the language, I guess. You're not really offered these different options. And I think, unfortunately, like it is just up to women to do this research themselves and to understand these different options that they have, to ask lots of questions. And I think a huge part is just understanding that, like, our healthcare system is a system. And unfortunately, everyone is basically placed into the same box, often regardless of their health, their current health and how they look after that. And so you also need to understand your individual risk for certain things. Now, I'm not saying no one should go and do the glucose tolerance test. I do think that maybe in some situations it is an appropriate test. I do think that's also questionable when we look at things like fructosamine. Why are we maybe getting women who do have gestational diabetes to even drink 75 grams of sugar, something that they're completely intolerant to, is sort of a little strange to me that we have other options, but we're still doing this test anyway. But, you know, I do think there are situations where that might be appropriate. But I think what's not appropriate is really just classing everyone into the same box. And then like from the management point of view as well, when you look at those recommendations, it also makes no sense that we're basically telling women to continue eating really high amounts of a food that they're intolerant to. Like at the end of the day, it's as simple as that. Getting that diagnosis means you're intolerant to that particular food. Doesn't mean you need to completely cut it out or go keto or anything wild like that, but you do need to like make some changes to your nutrition. But when you look at the guidelines, and even I guess bringing it right back to when you look at the just overall pregnancy guidelines, like women are recommended to eat 8.5 serves of grains a day. And I did the math sort of based off that, plus, you know, fruits and other sources where we might get carbohydrates from. It's like minimum 200, 250 grams of carbohydrates a day, which is fairly substantial for any female, but also very substantial for females that have a pre-existing issue with blood sugar. So it, you know, it's, I guess, really sad because I think you could be feeling like you're doing all the right things and literally be following the guidelines to a T, and that could be perpetuating the issue for you from the very start.
Wow. I think, what would be your biggest piece of advice then? So a woman's listening to this, she's early pregnancy. She is, you know, got all these, this journey ahead of her. And you've been on this journey yourself now, because it's different when you're a practitioner and then when you become pregnant, then you see things differently. So give us like an ABC, you know, you're pregnant, what do we do? Like, what's the best way to go about this?
Get blood tests done early in pregnancy so that you can make some really informed decisions early on about your blood sugar. So I sort of gave those markers earlier, but you want a HbA1c below 5.3%, ideally a fasting insulin of 3 to 5. Obviously, if yours is like 6, that's not an important difference, but much over that, and you're kind of wanting to be going, okay, I do have maybe a slight tendency toward insulin resistance, right? So I'm going to want to make some changes early on. And then a fasting blood glucose of under 5. With your iron, you're wanting a ferritin minimum of 50. You're wanting, there's other markers involved in iron status, but just for simplicity's sake, a ferritin a minimum of 50. And then you also want all of your key nutrients done as well, which is something we haven't sort of touched on, but things like zinc, iodine, you know, copper, you're wanting B12, folate, and ideally, like if it is available to you, getting those interpreted by someone who's not just looking at standard reference ranges, because the issue with our reference ranges in Australia is basically that they are averages. So for example, how those reference ranges might be created is the pathology lab takes all women 19 to 50 who went and had their iron tested between, you know, January 2021 and June 2021. They create the average of that, and that's what creates the reference range. But people who are sick, unwell, have deficiencies, aren't pulled out of the reference range creation. So that's why we end up with such wide, loosey-goosey reference ranges. So my other piece of advice there would be, if you are doing bloods and you're told like, yeah, everything looks fine, that's great, mm-hmm. nothing that you need to do, like you need to ask questions about that as well, because we see all the time in clinic where people are told their blood tests are fine, and it's just quite frankly not the case, because again, if we've got these really wide reference ranges, we're not picking up those like early wrong way go back signs, if that makes sense. There is a fantastic resource, I would also say, that's not my own, but Lily Nichols, I'm sure you maybe have heard of her before. She's a dietitian actually in Canada, and she's got an incredible book. So if you know, working with a practitioner one-on-one's not available to you, her book's called Real Food for Pregnancy. And she's also a diabetes educator as well. And she's a fantastic, amazing resource. So that book, you know, might be $30, $50, something like that. But it's sort of like your go-to Bible when it comes to pregnancy nutrition. So I would say if you can't work with someone one-on-one and get that personalized advice, your next best option would be purchasing that book, because she's fantastic.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you.
Yeah, that information is so valuable. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing that. I think it's going to help just, again, open up some questions. I hope it does for women to kind of start asking for themselves and really understanding the test, if it's, you know, if they're low risk, understanding their body more, because I think at the end of the day, when you understand how your body works, then that's when you can work with it. And like you said, if it's changing, it's quite simple, just, you know, changing certain foods you're intaking and things like, wow, like, yeah, because it's just, it's alarming to me. The diagnosis of gestational diabetes has increased so much over the last 10 years, really, since they changed the way that they test as well, I think, which is then leading to more intervention, more induction, which is then leading to more of a cascade of intervention, which is affecting women's experiences and trust in their body and the system, and what is that knock-on effect having when, if they came back to it, it may not have even been necessary. And this is just what Nicola and I are seeing on a weekly basis is, and then that fear-based, you know, the recommendations are coming in very fear-based, big baby, and it's turning from this gestational diabetes, you're going to have a big baby, you know, and it's just this knock-on effect that, we are seeing, and this is why this information is just so, so important. So how could women reach out to you or work with you preconception, or if they are already pregnant, or if they have a diagnosis, can you help them on this journey?
Yeah, definitely. So you can always come and find me on Instagram is really where I'm most active. So my handle there is selenedouglas_nutrition. Otherwise my website, which is just selenedouglas.com. So you can work with me one-on-one, which is really kind of like the most personalized way. We do all of the blood testing and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, very different to getting blood testing done if you've had that done in the past where you're told, oh, you know, this is a bit high or this is a bit low, here's a supplement, see you later. It's very in depth and very, I guess, strategic in how we action things as well and remeasure and remonitor different aspects of your health. But yeah, you can work with us or with me rather on a one-on-one consultation basis. I also have a small digital product called the A to Z Preconception Plan. So that's available as well on my website. And that will also give you all of the information about how to organize blood testing, preconception or in trimester one. And you can also find all of that information on assessing your blood sugar early and what markers you're looking for and really how to make those dietary tweaks if you do find that you have, say, a blood sugar issue or an iron issue or something like that. And there's all of the supplement information in there too.
And you have your own podcast too, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. I always forget to mention that. thank you. Yeah. I do have my own podcast that's called Holistic Health Chat. So that goes through basically all women's health issues and different topics involved in that. So yeah, you can find that on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
We'll definitely share all of that for you in our show notes. And thank you so much. And we'd love to have you on in the future, maybe when you can share your own birth story.
Yes, I would love to. I'm very excited.
I'm excited for you. But yeah, enjoy the rest of your pregnancy. And
thank you.
Hopefully we can have you on and you can share your beautiful
positive
birth story.
But thanks so much for having me. I've loved this conversation today. So thanks again.
Thank you.
We hope that you've enjoyed this episode and that it's helped you on your own journey. We would love it if you would subscribe and leave us a review.
To learn more about our individual online or face-to-face courses or be mentored by us for your own birth, please see our show notes for the links to our programs.